Hello and welcome to Risky Talk, the podcast where we talk about risk and how to talk about risk. I'm your host, David Spiegelhalter, and in this episode, we're exploring how to communicate about vaccines.
Vaccine sentiment is far more volatile than it was 10 and certainly 20 years ago.
The stakes couldn't be higher. And it's the stakes not just for vaccines, but it's actually the stakes for science.
This cannot rely on government-only engagement. We need local, trusted partners in the community.
We believe that around 3 million lives of young children are saved every year by immunization programs, and yet this misinformation has the risk of undermining that.
Vaccine news is coming thick and fast. Just after we finished recording this episode, Pfizer and Moderna hit the headlines with exciting preliminary results. And the very day we released the first edit of this episode, the Oxford vaccine shared their interim results. And so far, it's very good news indeed. But there's still a lot of work to be done over the coming months. As the regulatory bodies get to work and vaccine distribution centres are set up, will enough people want to take them? What rumours will surface? What concerns, objections and confusions might arise? And so in this episode, we're thinking about the long game. How do you communicate about vaccines with increasingly sceptical and polarised communities? Now, there's a long history to learn from when it comes to big international vaccination programmes. It's thanks to vaccines that smallpox has been eradicated and polio has been driven out of most countries around the world. According to a recent study, measles vaccination alone has saved more than 20 million lives over the last 15 years. But before COVID hit, progress was stalling, perhaps even reversing. 2019, for example, saw the highest number of measles cases since 2006, and vaccine hesitancy is ranked as one of the top threats to global health by the World Health Organization. Communicating about vaccines has never been higher stakes. So, what can we learn from the past? And as we focus on the coming months and years, how can we do it well? My guests today are going to help us answer that question. Professor Heidi Larson is the director of the Vaccine Confidence Project, which monitors public sentiment about immunisation programmes all over the world and advises governments and NGOs. Her recent book, Stuck, draws on her many years of experience in the field to explore how vaccine rumours start and why they don't go away. Heidi, welcome to Risky Talk.
Thanks, David. Happy to be here.
Professor Andrew Pollard is the director of the Oxford Vaccine Group and is currently leading the Phase 3 trial of the Oxford coronavirus vaccine. He's also behind the Vaccine Knowledge Project, a website that aims to be an accessible and authoritative source of information on all the major vaccines currently in use. So, welcome, Andrew.
Hi there. Very nice to have a chance to talk with you.
Well, it's wonderful to have you both with us. Thanks so much for taking time out of your incredibly busy schedules. Okay, now, communicating about vaccines has always been high stakes, but what's the pressure like now? How much does it matter that we actually do a good job?
Well, I think in many ways, from a communications point of view, you're absolutely right that the stakes couldn't be higher. And it's the stakes not just for vaccines, but it's actually the stakes for science, because we're really trying to underpin all of the work that we do on vaccine development by having absolutely rigorous science, so that when we do get to a point where hopefully we have a vaccine which works, that we have both from the scientific community and the public trust and confidence in that, because it has the potential to be transformative as one of the measures to control the pandemic and perhaps get our lives back to normal.
And Heidi, you recently described your life at the moment as being like Grand Central Station. Is everyone clamoring for your advice?
More than ever, in a sense, because of the amplification, as they call it, the social amplification of risk, just in terms of the misinformation and disinformation out there. Yeah, it's been a pretty demanding time.
You know, what's at stake at the moment?
Well, I think what's at stake is public confidence in vaccines. I actually often say that we don't really have a misinformation problem. Actually, we have a relationship problem, and we need to work on that engagement with the public. But we also need to listen. My concern about the what I think is a disproportionate focus on the misinformation crowds out the number of really genuine concerns that a lot of people in the public have. And I think we need to pay attention to those because there is a lot of uncertainty. And as you know, well, uncertainty is fertile ground for risk perceptions.
Well, I that's exactly what I want to ask you about, because at the Winton Center, we always bang on about how the first rule of good communication is to shut up and listen. And that seems to be a key part of what you do at the Vaccine Confidence Project. You know, why do you think that listening is so important in this area?
Well, I founded the Vaccine Confidence Project a decade ago now, and that was coming from my years of working with UNICEF, particularly leading on the introduction of new vaccines from 2000 to 2005. And we started to see basically an epidemic of individuals, communities, countries around the world starting to ask questions about vaccines. And I think, you know, sometimes there was an assumption, oh, that it's just emotion, it's not fact, just give them facts. And, you know, I would go out there being the anthropologist on staff, and they would say, go figure out what their problem is or what's worrying them. And I would sit with these groups of people, whether they were community or whether they were government, actually. You know, one thing you learn in anthropology, never assume what's in the minds of people. And also never forget that they can change. And so I would sit with women in Northern Nigeria who would say, you know, what makes us so angry is we hear on the radio that we're refusing the polio vaccine because we're ignorant. We wouldn't be asking questions if we were ignorant. So I think listening is important, and it's as important in remote corners of the world as it is in London.
So before we focus on the coronavirus vaccines coming down the line, let's explore some of the things we've learned from recent and ongoing work. Heidi, let's come to you first. Your group recently published a major survey mapping global trends in vaccine confidence from 2015 to 2019, and so from before the pandemic. And it was a big project. But can you give us an outline of what you found?
Well, we started listening basically to online media. It was kind of pre-social media, or at least the ubiquitousness of it. But then we realized you don't always know who is behind the social media. So we thought alongside the online media and increasingly social media we were listening to get more of the nuance of the conversations, we established what we call the Vaccine Confidence Index. And those are really basic, you know, what's your confidence in the importance, safety, effectiveness of vaccines, and is it religiously compatible with your religious or other beliefs? Four questions. We thought if it's any more than that, you can't manage to run it public globally. So from 2015 to 2019, and we continue to do it as we speak, we've been running these questions. And what we've seen is that one, vaccine sentiment is far more volatile than it was 10 and certainly 20 years ago. It changes. It's like almost like political opinion polling, but it also changes with the context that people are in, the political context, the relationship with government. And that's where I think relationships and trust relationships in particular, and you know from risk that trust and risk have an absolutely related. I mean, the more trust you have, the more you're willing to put up with a little bit of risk if you believe it's worth it, and vice versa. With low trust, you're looking for all the possible risks. And since we have one of the lowest trust times in trust recorded history, that's been amplified. But some things have gotten better a little bit, nothing dramatically better. But Europe, for instance, got a wake-up call with our 2015 study, and when we saw Europe was the most skeptical in the world. On the other hand, Northern Africa, Indonesia, had the biggest drop in confidence. And there are incidents and events behind that we pay attention to.
Yeah, you ask the same questions to everybody sort of all over the world, and you're saying it's strongly related to people's trust in their government and authorities. You know, can you give an idea of the variation that we see between different countries? What would be where would be high trust places? Where would be low trust places?
Highest in the world were Rwanda and Bangladesh. Bangladesh actually has a long history of community engagement from the early days of introducing vaccines in the early 80s. And there, this is one of the poorest countries in the world. And for all other indicators, you'd say, that would be low. Well, maybe their health indicators are low in some areas, but boy, have they gotten with the program on vaccines and really been engaging at a very local level from the beginning.
That's extraordinary. And so what about low trust places?
Well, Europe has really been, France in particular, wins the prize for the most skepticism in the world. But in terms of declines, Indonesia, there was really a very intentional movement by a group of Muslim leaders that declared that the MMR vaccine was religiously forbidden and undermining the government's program, basically. In southern India, we saw some drops in the Philippines, and that was a Dengvaxia vaccine. And in that case, actually, there was, and this is where things get complicated, there was a very small risk identified by the producer, by Sanofi Pasteur, but it became totally amplified and politicized. The same risk was reported in Brazil, which was the other country that was the first to introduce it. And they managed and carried on. Not that they don't have politics in Brazil, but somehow they managed it much better.
Oh, well, that brings us to the crucial next issue is how do you share information in a trustworthy way when it should include any information there is about possible harms of vaccines. Can you tell us a bit about your vaccine knowledge project? What are you trying to do with that?
Well, with the vaccine knowledge project, we were very aware that there are very few independent sources of information that are out there that try to be as comprehensive as possible and that just provide the facts, the evidence that there is around it, but hopefully in a way that's accessible to the public. And what we've done over the 10 years or so that we've been running this project is listen to the requests that come from the public about things they want to know about. And over time, populated the website with that information so that it's there, not with an interpretation, but just, for example, ingredients of vaccines. It's quite hard to find that information. And so we've worked quite hard to pull that information together. And now we have around 1 million hits a year on the website of people looking for information. And now almost every country in the world is using our website. And in fact, when we last looked, apart from the Vatican City, I think every country in the world had used the website at some point in the previous year.
If you listen to some of our other podcasts, you can see we drone on all the time about our principles in our centre being to inform rather than persuade. Do you think that's what you're trying to do? I mean, you do address the potential harms of vaccines.
Yes, I mean, I think our view is that we should be putting information out there that is evidence-based and accurate. And there are a number of well-known side effects of vaccines. I mean, I think for most of us who've had our flu vaccine this year, we'll know that we've got a sore arm, and some people will feel a little bit unwell in the day that they've had the vaccine. And those are extremely common, and there's no reason why we don't talk about those. It's exactly what's expected. And there are some very, very rare side effects of some vaccines, which are now well documented.
How do you communicate a small risk, a rare but serious side effect? Because I think that's a common problem in many of these areas.
I think you're absolutely right that one of the real challenges is communicating rare side effects. And of course, with the vaccines that are used currently, those rare side effects are very rarely very serious. And those that are serious are mostly self-limiting. And the difficulty is that when you've got a side effect which is vanishingly rare, the advantages still of having the vaccine far outweigh the risks of getting the disease, where severe complications and even death are common. And it is difficult when you're living in a population where the disease is no longer very common to balance those two as a parent, those two particular issues. And I think measles is a great example of that, where we've had a long period of time now, as you mentioned in the introduction, with almost no measles circulating in Europe. And there is absolutely no doubt that people have forgotten that 1 in 3,000 children in the UK would have died from measles if we go back 50 years or so ago. And indeed, in a poorer setting in lower middle income countries, maybe 1 in 200 children would die from measles. And it's very hard to balance that against very rare side effects that may be 1 in 1 million cases, like severe allergic reactions to vaccines, when there is no disease around. So people don't see the balance of those two together. And of course, what's happened is we've had a reduction in coverage of some of these vaccines. And we had deaths in Europe, as you mentioned, over the last couple of years as a result.
I suppose one of the few beneficial things from this virus will mean the cancellation of music festivals, which have become traditional breeding grounds for measles over the last few years. So, Heidi, we've heard all about the importance of sharing facts and communicating the evidence in a trustworthy way. But it's obvious from your previous examples that while communicating, you know, information like that is important, it's nowhere near enough. Can you share some of your experience here?
Sure. We work closely with the Vaccine Knowledge Project to make sure that the content is right. But if people have a deeper belief or alternative view, even the best information is not going to sink in, as it were. So we need to be working on multiple ways, and one is engaging in trust building and understanding those beliefs and making sure that information somehow situates itself in that context. One example that really, and frankly, this was probably the tipping point for me when I left the UN to set up the Vaccine Confidence Project. In northern Nigeria in 2003-2004, there was a boycott of the polio vaccination campaign. Now, I had been traveling around the world for UNICEF, listening to and addressing a number of smaller groups and individuals who were questioning UNICEF's vaccines. But this one in Nigeria really woke me up to a different phenomena, and that was a whole state boycotts a vaccine program. They're very conscious of the problem. This was only a rumor. There was no adverse event. There was distrust in central government. There was distrust in the bigger geopolitical environment on the heels of 9/11. So it was absolutely a distrust issue that was articulated by saying, those people out there are trying to sterilize you. Don't take this vaccine. So that's the kind of situation when you say, you know, well, the benefit of taking this compared to getting polio, and they're like, no, you don't get it. And our questions are very different. Also, this was on the heels of a meningitis drug trial where a number of children had died, and they were suspicious that that had been caused by the trial, even though it was determined that it was not caused by the drug. Pfizer was still sued for unethical, inadequate local consent. So this was distrust in big business, distrust in central government, distrust in the international authorities. What happened? Not only was it a statewide boycott, but it led to, I think it was nearly 20 countries reinfected as far as Indonesia, because it traveled along the Hajj pilgrimage route. And the Nigerian strain of the virus was found as far as Indonesia, costing the global polio program $500 million just to reset the lost progress because of this incident. To me, that is a compelling story about the difference between just misinformation and deep distrust issues.
Well, what is it about vaccines in particular that makes them so incredibly susceptible to this kind of politicization? All this distrust, this rumor?
Well, I think it's because I've thought a lot about this. A few things. One is it's all about relationships with government, because it's government that counts everyone. It's government that approves, regulates, recommends, and sometimes requires or mandates vaccines. So if you've got a difficult relationship with government, you're a minority group, you've had a bad experience with something in the government, doesn't have to even be vaccine related, you know, that already is an issue. On top of that, we're totally dependent on big business. If without big business and pharmaceutical companies, we would be nowhere with vaccines right now. So anyone who has an issue with big business, they're fine with government, but they have a real issue with big business. And I think those two, and the fact that all this counting is going on, that a global authority, the World Health Organization, collects the numbers from all the countries, who's being vaccinated, who isn't. In these days, I think a sense of being counted is not a comfort feeling for a number of populations in the world.
I mean, these sound quite plausible things that people should be concerned about. And so in your book, you talk about case studies in which you have engaged with populations. What do you think, you know, is a strategy for trying to, I wouldn't say persuade people to be vaccinated, but at least not to engage with the misinformation that's out there?
Well, I think for a start, we need to give them an alternative. Part of the reason, particularly in the context of COVID, that people are flooding their mailboxes and social networks are flooded with anti or alternative or partial information is because we're not there with an alternative. And so I think the first thing we need to do, even if it's an interim, keep people engaged around it so they're not feeling like they need to look elsewhere and go down the rabbit hole, as they say. We also have to remember that if there's one thing that really has struck me about the whole amplification of risk, as it were, in the context of COVID, is that we often say, well, one of the reasons we have all this questioning is because we've done such a great job with vaccines that, you know, people don't see the threat of the virus anymore. Well, that excuse went out the window with COVID-19. This was a huge threat with high numbers of fatalities, people with disabling and chronic symptoms. We might be seeing lifelong symptoms of COVID because we don't even know yet, because we've only been with it for less than a year now. And so even in the face of those threats, we see this, you know, even bigger misinformation. So we can't rely on just fixing the problem there. So I think giving an alternative, I think working on the trust building to answer your question on how do you deal with this, you know, I call it kind of surround sound. I think to the extent that I work closely with some of the social media platforms, they are coming to ask, where do we start with all this? Because it's such a massive thing. And, you know, if they can rein it in a bit on their side, particularly at the back end with the algorithms, if they don't feel like they can confidently shut something down because it's not overtly harmful enough, what they can do is cut it off on the back end from being sent to millions and billions of people. I mean, and it's really billions in some cases. So there are things they can do to turn off, slow down the tap anyway, while we surround, you know, I think we need to look at it in an ecosystem perspective and not just trying to hit the misinformation on the head.
Okay, let's focus on the enormous challenge ahead of rolling out the vaccine for the coronavirus, assuming it's successful in its phase 3 trials. Now, I don't want to talk about the specifics of the vaccine and all those issues. That's not what we're concerned with. We're concerned here solely with sort of strategies for communication. And I'd really like to know what's in your mind about how, you know, if the phase 3 trials are successful, what you're thinking about how this might might be communicated to the public, both the science and the possibility of side effects and so on. So, I mean, let's just start about dealing with propaganda. And I think you've had a taste of this recently, the bizarre news from Russia, maybe producing memes, you know, and TV clips claiming the Oxford vaccine will have some terrible effects on you, like turning you into a monkey. Andy, do you think this is a sign of things to come? Are you prepared for the opposition that you might be meeting?
Well, I think that the area around misinformation is clearly very troubling. But particularly here, we believe that around 3 million lives of young children are saved every year by immunization programs, which are incredibly well tested and monitored and safe. And yet this misinformation has the risk of undermining that. I think as far as communication about it, the first step, and I think as the scientists like myself who are involved in leading trials both here and internationally, is to make sure that we communicate that process. How do trials work? What are we actually doing to document the safety, and how confident can we be in whether they work or not? What are we doing to get the information that builds that confidence in the result? And then, of course, the next bit is to make sure that there is a good understanding of what the processes are that take us from, you know, an academic or a company doing a clinical trial to actually making a decision to use a vaccine. Who's going to look at all of that and scrutinize it? And we have very highly regulated processes in national law here in the UK, as also with international law around Europe, that will result in very close scrutiny of what has been done in the trials and all of the quality of the manufacturing and so on, that helps to fill that gap in about whether or not a vaccine is safe to use and what it's going to say on the label. The label will give absolute clarity about what's happened in the trials and who we think the vaccine might work in and so on.
Well, we've had Sander van der Linden and others on this podcast sort of recommending this idea of pre-bunking or inoculation, where you actually hit people with the misinformation even before they've heard it from on social media necessarily, you know, in a small dose to say, do you know there's people saying this? And sort of get in there first to counter the misinformation. I'm not sure whether you've considered those strategies.
Yes, I mean, I think you're right that there are lots of behavioural science experts in this area, and I think we really need to have advice from them. Of course, one of the problems is you never quite know what the next bit of misinformation is, and this recent story is certainly not one that we might have anticipated. but you're right that where there are things where we can anticipate them, it's extremely important to address them up front.
Heidi, from your perspective, do you think the authorities are prepared in the UK and globally to effectively communicate with the public about a COVID vaccine when one eventually arrives? You know, taking into account what we've just heard about the fact that there is both, you know, genuine information about potential harms and benefits, as well as extensive misinformation as well.
Well, I've been in a number of discussions with various departments in government and have seen the combined strategy for communication. And I think, you know, all the bits are in there, are important, but I think we need to get on with it. I think we need to move past the planning stage, and the clock is ticking. And I think the most important thing we can do now is listen. And because once we have that vaccine, I mean, you could say, well, we can't communicate until we know the stats. Yes, we have to wait for some of the specifics. But in the meanwhile, at a minimum, we should work on that trust building. We should work on that listening. What are your concerns? We'd like to, because if we know the questions now, at least we can start to get our ducks lined up for being able to respond to those questions.
What might those ducks look like? I mean, when one hears the concerns, which are being voiced, you know, quite loudly at the moment already, how would you design that communication strategy very broadly?
Right now, I would start identifying people. We know pretty well the landscape of where the resistance is. There's a lot of general concern, and that I think is perfectly legitimate in terms of questions, because there are a lot of questions. But I think we also know where there historically has been some issues with just vaccine. I mean, my neighborhood, I live in Hackney, some of the worst vaccinating rates in the country. And some of that is because it's a highly mobile, it's a highly multi-ethnic, some of its language issues, some of its marginalization. There's a lot of issues, but we do have a bit of a background, and that's the objective of our Vaccine Confidence Index, to have that mapping and know where there's more vulnerability to not being compliant. So start there. We need local trusted partners in the community, not just in the clinic. And now is the time where we can try to find those people.
You've mentioned social media already, and actually the role of algorithms for detecting misinformation and actually trying to prevent its sort of unlimited spread. I mean, do you think that social media is really changing the whole environment for vaccine confidence? Or do you think it's just sort of exaggerating it more than it has been?
Well, I think it's changing because, you know, there's individual psychology and then there's group psychology and behavior. And I think what's happening with social media is that because you can surround yourself with people who think like you, it emboldens your confidence in a particular point of view in ways that, in even bigger ways than before. So it's not just the spread of it, but it's the strength of it in terms of, you know, endorsing people's concerns. And that makes it tougher when it's an anti-concern or when it's an anxiety. It kind of not only amplifies the spread, but the depth of the emotions, which makes it more challenging for the public health community.
Mm. Do you think that, I mean, I'm sure you can't give details, but is government listening to all of this?
I think government, they are trying, but I think there's a lot of demands on government right now. They're pretty stretched thin. They're running to catch up. To me, I think it has to be an all of society approach. This cannot rely on government only engagement.
Okay, so let's say we've got a vaccine that's been shown to work. It meets all the safety criteria, the regulators give it the thumbs up, and it's the first to be widely distributed. As it gets rolled out, there will almost certainly be reports of adverse reactions. I mean, some of them may have happened anyway without the vaccine, and some may be genuine. Andy, how do you think we might deal with those claims, you know, which are, you know, I think almost bound to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think in trials, you, as you mentioned, you have tens of thousands of people in a trial like this, which is actually far more than for many drugs and vaccines that are normally developed. So we actually have huge trials. But they only tell you about events that happen frequently enough that you can detect them in that size of population. So if you have something which is 1 in 100,000 in a trial of 10 to 20,000, you're very unlikely to see those events. And so as with most drugs and vaccines, you have to have good surveillance systems after the vaccines are deployed. And for that, you then need to be able to monitor what's happening in the vaccinated populations. And many countries around the world now have those systems in place. They're really important for when events happen after vaccination, which of course they will, because stuff happens to all of us all the time, whether we're vaccinated or not.
Exactly.
And when those events happen, we need to be able to try and track whether or not those are just as you'd expect to have cases occurring in a population at the same rate as normal, or whether the rate has changed. And that requires really good data about what normally happens in a population. And actually, there's not so many countries that have that. Fortunately, we're in one here where there are quite good data, and that helps to inform the discussions when people do make claims, as they should do. People should report events that happen so that they can be looked into.
Heidi, how do you think we should respond when those stories, as no doubt they will, start circulating?
I think we need to be ready for it. I think that it's inevitable with the scale of vaccination we're expecting that, as you mentioned, there are coincidental things happening, but we all should be ready, also should be ready for a possible genuine adverse event that is related to the vaccine or related to the vaccination experience. WHO this past year has finally acknowledged that this isn't just about vaccine safety, but vaccination safety, and that there is this immunization stress-related reaction, which historically we've called psychosomatic. We also need, and I would put this also in the priority lane, a communication strategy with healthcare professionals. We should not assume that even because they're the first in line to receive the vaccine, they are going to be, you know, eagerly waiting to get it. They were one of the more hesitant groups around H1N1 vaccine, and that was a much more familiar vaccine and even an old virus that had recurred, a virus strain. So one, we need to see what their confidence levels are for accepting the vaccine. And two, they're going to be the front line in hearing a lot of questions. And one of the biggest one will be if there is any kind of adverse event. So they're the ones we really need to help and support.
The next year is going to be an extraordinarily challenging time when it comes to vaccines. And I'm just interested in what your feelings are about this. You end your book with the thought that you're a patient optimist. Is that how you feel at the moment? I mean, what do you mean by that?
As you might have picked up, that was kind of to counter the tagline of the Gates Foundation, which is impatient optimists. And I don't think impatience with some of the concerns of the public is, as we see with the fast narrative, that's not necessarily the best trust builder. I'm patient because I think the younger generation that's coming in has been digital natives, as they call them, much more fluent in that, much less assuming of that kind of sense of authority, and we're the ones who know. I think it's going to be a different dynamic. We're also seeing some of the younger children of anti-vaccine or vaccine-refusing mothers saying, wait a minute, this was not my choice. I know better. I need this vaccine, whether it's a measles vaccine, or we've seen some of these younger kids, you know, stand up and say, you know, my mom was really, I don't know why she didn't want a vaccine, but I know better. And some of them are networking. So I think alongside the work we need to do now to deal with the reality now, there is, I think, a positive trend that could help.
Andy. How about you? Are you optimistic about the way a coronavirus vaccine will be received by the public in the coming months?
Well, I think if we have conducted rigorous trials and we demonstrate vaccines work and we can describe the safety profile of them, and we look at where we are going into the winter now with increases in cases and hospitalizations, I think there will be a large number of people who will recognize that being vaccinated may have a really important impact on the disease and perhaps what's happening in society. And unfortunately, we almost certainly that not everyone will take the vaccines, but at least I hope a high proportion of people will have that confidence from the trials. And over time, if we can demonstrate the impact of new programs of whichever vaccines are used, then I think that will build confidence over time when we see this disease diminishing, severe cases diminishing in those who are vaccinated, then that will help. But before we get to that step, we really have to demonstrate through these rigorous trials that that actually is likely to be the case when we roll out.
So your approach, to summarise it, is to really demonstrate the rigour of the scientific process that's going into the development and evaluation of these vaccines, and in order to demonstrate, you know, a trustworthy conclusion. Just finally, you're in a very challenging time at the moment. How does this compare with the challenge of climbing Everest?
I think that my experiences in climbing in the past have been extremely important in perhaps teaching how critical teamwork is in order to achieve a goal. And you can't do something like this without an amazing team of people around you. And I think also the resilience that's needed to keep going despite misinformation and enormous pressures of work that are required to do it.
But you got to the summit.
I got to the just below the south summit of Everest, not to the actual main summit.
Well, it's still pretty good. Very impressive. Okay, well, that brings us to the end. We've covered a lot. We've explored how to share clear and balanced evidence on the benefits and potential harms of vaccines, but we've also explored why facts are just not enough on their own. Trust building, community engagement, and listening are key. We've also addressed some of the tough problems we're likely to face when the first coronavirus vaccines are rolled out, and how careful surveillance and assessment will be crucial. So it just remains for me to say a really deep thank you to my guests, Professor Heidi Larson and Professor Andrew Pollard, and an even deeper good luck as they continue to navigate this tricky area. It's goodbye from me and the Risky Talk team.
Risky Talk is produced by Elan Goodman at the Winton Centre for Risk and Evidence Communication in the University of Cambridge.